You know, every time I bring Heather McDonald on this show, I say that she is one of the very top reporters in the country. And then sometimes I think, am I being too fulsome in my flattery? And then I go research again and have to go back and read her stuff. And she is one of the best reporters in the country, if not the very best. She just is doing work that no one else is doing. She is absolutely terrific on race, on cops. She has a new book coming out called When Race Trumps Merit, How the Pursuit of Equity Sacrifices Excellence, Destroys Beauty, and Threatens Lives. Officially, it's available for pre-order on Monday, but it's actually, I'm looking at the Amazon page, it's available for pre-order now. Pre-order it because her stuff is absolutely great. Heather, it's great to see you.
I love that plug. Thank you so much, Andrew.
So let's talk about Tyre Nichols. I'm sure you watched these videos. What did you take away from this?
I took away that training in Memphis is absolutely abysmal for police officers, and possibly recruitment standards are as well. This was a deplorable stain on the profession of policing. I don't believe it's representative at all, but I completely understand the public's dismay and the desire to understand whether this is in fact a candid window into mistreatment that's going on every day. I don't think it is. I think the left and President Biden is demagoguing it, but it is a fair question to ask after seeing something as completely antithetical to the standards of police profession as these videos have shown us.
That's what it looked like. It did look absolutely terrifying. We've all been stopped for traffic violations, and it's just a frightening thing to think about. Why were five guys from this elite elite division, the Scorpion division, why were they doing a traffic stop, do you think?
Oh, well, traffic stops are quite important in fighting violent crime. The National Traffic Safety Highway Administration has an entire program and has had one for decades on what it calls the nexus between crashes and crime. It turns out that neighborhoods with the highest levels of violent crime also have the worst driving. I know a criminologist at the University of Cincinnati who's done research in Over the Rhine, which is Cincinnati's inner city neighborhood. And he says that the driving behavior you see there just makes your hair stand up on end. You know, people running red lights all the time, speeding past school zones, completely indifferent to children on the street. So it's perfectly appropriate to be looking for reckless driving, because also, Andrew, it is what residents of high crime neighborhoods want the police to do. There was a video that came out of North Minneapolis after the George Floyd riots completely destroyed law enforcement there, of a high school principal after there'd just been a shooting of a student, one of her students, a fatal shooting. And what she was complaining about is the fact that people were speeding like crazy through the neighborhood. Now, the Memphis Police Department is trying to discredit the officers' reports that Mr. Nichols was driving down the wrong way of a street. But frankly, that behavior would not be at all out of the norm for a neighborhood in a city with the violent crime problem and the disorder problem that Memphis has.
So let's talk about this. All the cops were black. Nichols is obviously black. And yet we're still told that this is a race problem. And from one perspective, I can sort of see why that might be true. The lovable, always trustworthy Al Sharpton came out and said they wouldn't have done this in the white side of town. But I've been to Memphis, and the black side of town is really bad. It is really frightening in some of those neighborhoods there. And, you know, does that affect the way police look at black people?
You know what? We'll have to be honest. Police every day see a reality that Americans completely turn their eyes away from.
Yeah.
And that is an extraordinary psychological burden, because the rest of the country is going around pretending that there aren't vast behavioral disparities and that the only reason for the overrepresentation of blacks in prison or the underrepresentation of blacks as Google computer engineers must be racism. Whereas in fact, you have an inner city culture that is simply pathological. There is no other way to explain these 15 and 16 year olds that are almost joyfully spraying sidewalks with bullets, indifferent to the fact that they're taking down toddlers in the process. So, you know, it would be very unrealistic psychologically to say that police officers are not on their guard in high crime neighborhoods. I remember after one of the highly publicized police shootings in New York City of a young man, Sean Bell, who was coming out of a strip joint, and I think he was in his car, was a gangbanger, and there was some sort of traffic altercation, and the police did shoot, killing Mr. Bell. A representative of the detectives union told me, we would be willing to stipulate that officers may be a little faster on the trigger when confronting black suspects if the left were willing to acknowledge that the reason for that is the vastly disproportionate rates of black crime. I mean, let me just throw one more statistic at you, Andrew, and then get back to our conversation. Blacks between the ages of 10 and 24 die of gun homicide at 25 times the rate of whites between the ages of 10 and 24. They're not being killed by the police. They're not being killed by whites. They're being killed by other blacks. Blacks commit gun homicide at about 25 times the rate of whites. And police officers, 42% of all cop killers on average are black males, even though black males are 6% of the population. A police officer is 400 times as likely to be killed by a black as an unarmed black is to be killed by a police officer. So those things matter. By and large, however, our usual test for racist policing, which is simply that arrests and stops are disproportionately black, is not a valid test of racism. That disproportion is the inevitable result of enforcing the law.
Wow. See, now you came up, I believe, with the phrase the Ferguson effect, the police drawing back when this this publicized investigations take place and these charges are slung about. But one of the things I just heard yesterday was that police are now having a terrible time recruiting because nobody wants to be a cop because the cops are given no respect. And in fact, the opposite. So now you said you looked at this video and you saw really poor training. Police departments are forced to lower their standards because they're not getting the number of recruits they need. So you're in this kind of cycle of death, basically, brought on by the continual pounding of this racial theory, which doesn't really hold up. It doesn't actually describe reality. And just in the last minute, you've given more facts. You've spoken more facts to this audience than they might be getting if they were watching ABC, CBS, or NBC. And yet you are never invited onto those networks. You're, well-respected, many awards and all that, but not by those people. So how does this break through? Do you despair? I mean, is there any chance of somehow changing this narrative?
It's quite extraordinary. You know, the chief of police in Washington, D.C., it just came out with a statement saying this unbelievably radical so-called criminal reform bill that is unwinding law enforcement even further in the name of fighting disparate impact. What about the criminal? What about the victims? And what's so amazing is that the race activists have thrown their lot in with black criminals rather than black victims, because it is the fact that blacks are way, way over victimized by violent street crime. 10,000 blacks were killed in 2020. That's 3,000 more than all whites and Hispanics combined, even though blacks are only 13% of the population. But the left would somehow rather privilege the criminal than the victim. I can't begin to explain it. And, you know, it wasn't turned around in the 2020 midterm elections. I do not think crime played a significant role there, despite the much closer race in New York City for the state governor, because the Republican was focusing on crime, but elsewhere it didn't matter. And at this point, it kind of looks like the people who care the most about Black victims of crime are white conservatives.
Yeah.
And when they finally are told one too many times by the New York Times that to raise the alarm about crime is racist, and they say, okay, fine, you know, fine with us, we'll walk away, then nothing's going to happen. What will turn it around is if white kids start getting shot in drive-by shootings. Mm-hmm. Right now, yeah, it's almost exclusively Black children, toddlers, three-year-olds, five-year-olds, gunned down in their beds, in their front porches, at birthday parties, jumping on trampolines in their parents' car. It's Black children that are getting gunned down. Al Sharpton has nothing to say about it. Benjamin Crump has nothing to say about it. If this spills over into white communities, then you'll see change.
It, you know, it's a kind of racism that when they talk about Black, when liberals talk about Black people, they mean Black criminals. It's almost as if they think that is representative of Black life, which it actually is not. I mean, it is representative of a problem in Black life. There's a theory that the federal government, one of the things that happens after these well-publicized shootings is that the federal government sometimes tries to gain oversight over the local police. And usually that means a further hike in crime because the federal government restrains the local law enforcement. Do you think that there's an underlying effort by the federal government to take over local policing?
No, I don't. That's a conspiracy theory.
Okay.
They wouldn't possibly be able to do that. But I just think that Democratic politicians, and Joe Biden has been the most inflammatory both before and after the Tyree Nichols shooting. It's absolutely criminal what he's been saying. He's pulled out his favorite trope about Blacks, you know, being in daily fear of their lives from the police. That's an ideological position for them. It's going to make Blacks more resistant to the police, more likely to resist arrest, more violence directed at officers, and as you say, more officers backing off from sound constitutional colorblind proactive policing. More Black lives will be taken, and you know it's not going to matter to Biden, because what he cares about is this narrative of pervasive white supremacy.
You know, I've only got about a minute left, but your new book is called When Race Trumps Merit: How the Pursuit of Equity Sacrifices Excellence, Destroys Beauty, and Threatens Lives. Can you give us a little bit about what's in there?
Well, it looks at disparate impact theory. It turns out we're tearing down every meritocratic and behavioral standard, no matter how colorblind and fair, because they do have a disparate impact on Blacks. And the only allowable explanation at present for that disparate impact is racism. So we've decided that, a medical school admissions test must be racist somehow if Blacks are not admitted to medical schools in their proportional numbers at 13%, or the medical school licensing exam must be racist if it does not qualify as many Blacks to continue in their medical careers as whites and Asians. And so we're tearing those standards down. And I provide an alternative explanation, which is there are very, very large academic skills gaps and behavior gaps that explain the overrepresentation of Blacks in prison and the underrepresentation of Blacks in our most meritocratic institutions. 66% of Black 12th graders do not even possess partial mastery of 12th grade math skills, which are very elementary. It's basic arithmetic,
yeah,
and knowing how to read a graph. 6% of Blacks are fully college ready, according to the ACT exam. So how do we go from that, which we refuse to look at, and expect that absent racism, all of Google's engineers, there'll be 13% Google engineers or 13% researchers in a cancer or Alzheimer's lab. So I am making a call for a return to colorblind meritocratic standards and honesty about the real reason for racial disparities in our country. Because at present, as long as racism is the only allowable explanation for racial disparities, it is all coming down. Every institution is going to be dragged down.
Heather McDonald, the new book is called When Race Trumps Merit. When it comes out, come back. You can come back anytime. I always love talking to you. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Andrew.
For more great content, like and subscribe, and subscribe to The Andrew Klavan Show wherever you get your podcasts.
Let it sink in that people would rather be dead than continue to deal with this tyrannical, abusive, dominating government, this administration.
Yeah, Sharona, I just want to say too, one of the most known, well, that's not even the right word because not enough people know, but probably the most well-known case of a suicide with January 6th is the case of Matthew Perna. And he was facing a misdemeanor charge. The government came to him and it said, if you plead guilty, we'll drop all these charges against you. You'll plead to one misdemeanor. He decided to take that deal, sounded like the most reasonable path forward. Then after he signed the plea deal, after he pled guilty to this misdemeanor, then they went back to him and they said, oh, yes, we're charging you with a misdemeanor, but we're also going to add a terrorism enhancement to your sentencing recommendation. So rather than the 6 months maximum that you were facing in prison for your misdemeanor charge, you're now facing 4 to 6 years in prison on a misdemeanor because we're adding a terrorism enhancement. They told him that after he pled guilty. And at that point, he went into his garage and hung himself.
Welcome back to America's Mom. Today we have the esteemed Dr. Mark McDonald, America's frontline doctor, and Brandon Strack, the founder of the Walkaway Movement. I don't gotta wait no more, chasing after things that they just can't tell you. Tell me I don't wait no more, seen it all change and I know that's for you. Tell me not to wait too long, I don't gotta wait when I make this for you. Tell them not to wait too long. Today's show is brought to you by Small Business Alliance Network, connecting American companies across the country. If you're paying any attention at all right now, the egg hatcheries are burning down, the chicken hatcheries are burning down, and everyone is wondering what in the world is Biden going to do next to destroy this country. There seems to be nothing you can really put your feet on right now. There's no stable ground. Everywhere you look, it really seems to be absolute chaos. From Russia to Ukraine, we keep waiting for the exposure. We keep waiting for Biden to be held accountable, for Hunter Biden to finally be facing the same kind of charges for actual racketeering, for actual treason, for actually selling out the American people that they've put on our January 6th patriots. People who went to the Capitol on January 6th, 2020 are still under assault by the federal government. And assault's the best word I can think of to use because that's exactly what they've done to people. Pulled them out of their beds in the middle of the night, taken their lives, put them under unbelievable, stupid charges that have nothing to do with what actually went on at the Capitol that day, while never telling you about the other 14,000 hours of footage that show the DC police were escorting people into the people's house because it is the people's house. And it was inauguration day. We're never going to see all of this stuff come to justice, it seems like. But I hope that you will agree with me that yes, we are going to have our day of justice because God is just. He is a just God. Our time together today starts with Brandon Strack. And I do an introduction for him, and you'll hear that in a second. But I just want to point out something. People who stood up for our country deserve our support. People who have given it all and laid it all on the line, and they never caved, they never cowered, they never hid away. They deserve our support and they need it. 4 of our January 6th people have committed suicide because to die would be better than to continue to face a dictatorial government. We are literally under communism in this Biden regime, and we can't abandon each other. One of the most helpful lines I've ever heard was, "I will walk with you as far as I can. I don't need to be in full agreement with you. You don't need to be in full agreement with me. But the people who lay their lives down,
who do everything they can to secure our way of life, our freedom, our liberty, our future, our children. I want to walk with them. I want to tell their stories to you so that you can, one, pray for them, two, continue to contribute and support them financially, even bringing them to your cities and letting other people hear their stories so they know what's going on in this country. And finally, to share their stories out. We're not doing America's Mom because we have nothing better to do. I have four kids. I have a busy life. So do you. We do this show so we can tell their stories, so they won't be forgotten, so it won't be swept under the rug, so that there won't be amnesty for those who involved themselves in the reduction of our liberties, who took away people's lives, their jobs, their security. There will be no amnesty for that. We have to remember what has happened in this country, and there has to be a pathway forward, and it involves every single one of us. So on today's show, please keep that in mind. We need to support one another voluntarily. We don't need force. You will do it because you love this country. I will do it because I love this country. We were actually, we all won the lottery the day we were born in America. So these stories today, hope you'll really listen. With open hearts, walk as far as you can. Because this country, we need a little bit of unity, and we need a whole lot of courage.
You've got thousands of people who are walking away from the Democratic Party saying, this is the reason why. If the Democratic Party and the people on the left had a single functioning brain cell in their head, what I've done here basically for them is done all the work of creating a focus group for them. I mean, if any of them simply went to the page and watched the video testimonials of the people telling them exactly where the Democratic Party has gone wrong, I mean, this could actually be an incredibly useful tool for the Democratic Party. But are they going to take this opportunity? Are they going to use it? No. They're going to close their eyes and close their ears and say, this isn't happening, this isn't happening. Well, it is happening. It's still happening. It's going to continue to happen until you change your party.
Fewer movements across the country during the Trump era garnered so much support than the walkaway movement. This was a cry out for all of those disenfranchised Democrats, unaffiliated voters, people who had not been involved in politics for years because they were sick of the political nonsense. They were sick of not being represented. They wanted change if they were going to participate in this conversation. It was a wildly effective movement led by a man named Brandon Strack. Well, since that effort began, eyes have been on him. He did not meet the standard to walk away. He was supposed to be entrenched in the left forever. He was gay. He was artistic. He was outgoing. He was all these Hollywood scene, and he was never supposed to leave the plantation, but he did. And not only did he leave the plantation, but he brought millions of people with him. Well, fast forward to January 6th, Brandon Strack shows up on the day that we hoped somehow President Trump would be reinstated. Somehow he would find himself back in the White House representing the people. We would all be back to living the good life and watching America be great. So sick of winning. That was what was supposed to happen, or what we believed and hoped would happen. Instead, Brandon faced the same trauma that many across this country are facing right now. The day that he was condemned, called a domestic terrorist, and his life has never been the same. He's going to share part of his story today, and we'll be sitting down with him next month. But I wanted you to meet this great man who has stood on his principles. He has stayed true to his beliefs, no matter what has come against him, and a lot has come against him. Brandon, thank you for joining us on America's Mom. You've had quite a go with the federal government. And of course, January 6th definitely has rocked your world. Talk us a little bit about what's happened with your sentencing, and then bring us up to speed with what just recently occurred.
Sure. So I was sentenced in January of 2022, which was almost an entire year. It was 364 days to the day that the FBI initially came into my house at dawn, got me out of bed, put me in handcuffs, and took me to jail. And a team of agents in tactical gear began rifling through my apartment and collecting computers, phones, iPads, camera equipment, hard drives, thumb drives, clothing, and putting them into bags and taking my things. And initially, the government charged me with multiple felonies and threatened this very unusual felony of obstruction of Congress, which is a charge that has never been used this way in the history of law. It's something that they kind of bent and contorted to be able to use against January 6th defendants. Needless to say, I ended up taking a misdemeanor plea deal. They dropped the felony charges, but for my sentencing for this Class B misdemeanor charge ended up being 3 months of house arrest, 3 years of federal probation, 60 hours of community service, a $5,000 fine, $500 restitution payment to the Capitol, and court-ordered mental health evaluation and mental health services. Now, that was after I had already spent 2.5 days in jail when they initially got me, and it probably bears mentioning I never entered the Capitol on January 6th.
That was going to be my next question. Did your body ever even cross into the building that the DC police were ushering people into?
No, I never entered the Capitol, and I was never accused of entering the Capitol or engaging in any violence or vandalism or theft or destruction. So although they came at me with a number of charges, including felonies, I was never at any point accused of any violence or destruction or vandalism or entering the building.
Well, this is really significant because this is what we're talking about, the weaponizing of this Department of Justice, of Biden's regime. He's taken every branch, every three-letter agency that we have, and this new, you know, this whole new entire branch of government, and he's used it against people who object to his policies, object to his administration. So what you're talking about is radical. It's outrageous. But the fact of the matter is, it hasn't even stopped there. You served or are in the process of serving out the sentence to which you agreed to after all of these threats. And I don't think people understand. The federal government has unlimited power. They have unlimited money and resources to just absolutely destroy you until you are no more. Yes. And I don't think people get it. They haven't been, those who haven't been on the side of that, they can, you know, flap their jaws all day long about how you should do this or do that. They have no idea what it's like to be on the receiving end of a government that will not stop. It is literally, it's a terrifying place to be. But the thing about you, you have really demonstrated courage. You haven't shut up, Brandon. They didn't achieve what they ultimately wanted, was to scare you into silence. You brought millions of people off their plantation, and they don't want you to take that authority again and move forward. And yet you're doing it. And so therefore, there's a new chapter of government overreach and tyranny in your life. What are they doing to you now?
Well, so what has happened now is, and I'd like to just say one thing before I answer this question, sure. Because a moment ago you said they have unlimited power and money and resources to basically come at you or come at a person over and over again until that person, I believe your words were, until you are no more. And I don't think you could have possibly phrased it better, because a lot of people also don't understand that there are now, I believe, 4 January 6th defendants who have committed suicide because they've had to go through this process. And we're not talking about people who are facing, life in prison for killing somebody, literally people who are facing misdemeanor charges. When is the last time you've ever heard of somebody killing themselves because of going through a misdemeanor case? But that is what has happened now at this point with 4 different January 6th defendants who made the decision that it would be easier to end their lives than to continue trying to take on the federal government as their lives are being destroyed by our government. And
pause for, I just want everybody watching to let that sink in for a second. Let it sink in that people would rather be dead than continue to deal with this tyrannical, abusive, dominating government, this administration.
Yeah, and Sharona, I just want to say too, one of the most known, well, that's not even the right word because not enough people know, but probably the most well-known case of a suicide with January 6th is the case of Matthew Perna. And he was facing a misdemeanor charge. The government came to him and it said, if you plead guilty, we'll drop all these charges against you. You'll plead to one misdemeanor. He decided to take that deal, sounded like the most reasonable path forward. Then after he signed the plea deal, after he pled guilty to this misdemeanor, then they went back to him and they said, oh, yes, we're charging you with a misdemeanor, but we're also going to add a terrorism enhancement to your sentencing recommendation. So rather than the 6 months maximum that you were facing in prison for your misdemeanor charge, you're now facing 4 to 6 years in prison on a misdemeanor because we're adding a terrorism enhancement. They told him that after he pled guilty. And at that point, he went into his garage and hung himself.
Brandon, that's why we're not going to let your story die. And those that we're getting in touch with from January 6th who are being bombarded with felonies, after threats, after, it's Groundhog Day for people who went to the People's House on January 6th and had any influence whatsoever. So we're not going to let this story die. And right now, the federal government has come again with threats that they made before. They've just decided to make good on those. And what are they telling you now?
Well, so what I'm currently enduring is actually a civil case. So what has happened is there is a nonprofit law firm in Washington, D.C. called Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law. I would recommend anyone take just a cursory look at their website. And what you'll find very quickly is that this is what I call a social justice law firm. They're George Soros funded. And what they do is they take the millions and millions of dollars at their disposal and they use them to engage in lawfare against conservatives, and not just trying to sue conservatives to try to destroy their lives, which is the end goal. But in addition to putting them through the lawfare and the expense, the crippling expense, they engage in lawsuits where they accuse people of being white supremacists and racists and try to destroy people's reputations. And so what they did with me was they served me in a civil suit along with about three dozen other people suing us under the KKK Act. And they found nine Capitol police officers who are Black and brown people who were working on January 6th. To be clear, I never met these people. I never saw these people. I never came in contact with these people. As far as I know, I believe they were working on the other side of the building as I was on. I was on the east side. I believe these officers were working on the west side. If in fact these officers were harmed or injured, I'm sincerely sorry for that. Nobody should have harmed any officers on January 6th. That's something that should never happen. However, I didn't harm these officers. I did not encourage anybody to harm these officers. I didn't encourage anybody to harm anybody on January 6th. Nonetheless, because of who I am, they've included me in a lawsuit. They came at me with six counts, suing me under the KKK Act. And finally, last week, Judge Maida in Washington, D.C. ruled on our motion to dismiss, and he's keeping me in the case on two out of six counts. So I now have to begin this process all over again and potentially be going to trial in front of a jury in Washington, D.C., facing counts of aiding and abetting assaults and aiding and abetting battery against nine Capitol Police officers that I've never met in my entire life.
Incredible. And what is the premise of that? What is it? Because you were a social media influencer, you led the walkaway movement, you had millions of people who made the decision to leave the Democrat Party. Is that basically what this is about, your ability to connect with people?
Well, I would say in the simplest possible terms, if we look at like the legality of the case, I think that what they're alleging essentially is that because I pled guilty to a misdemeanor charge of disorderly conduct. So I have a Class B misdemeanor disorderly conduct conviction. And they're using that to say, well, you know, the nature of his disorderliness was that he was outside of the building, riling up the crowd, encouraging people with his presence. And that if not for my riling up the crowd, those officers on the other side of the building may not have gotten hurt.
What a reach.
I think so. But, you know, I think I'll tell you something. There's a lawyer that I spoke with recently who said to me, he's been working on a lot of these January 6th cases, more on the criminal side, but a little bit on the civil side as well. And he told me, Brandon, those of us lawyers who are doing the defense in these January 6th cases have kind of coined a new term now that we use that we call J6 jurisprudence. And he said what that means is the law in DC as it's applied since January 6th, because he said we've never seen the law applied in the ways that it's being applied now since January 6th, and that there are judges and prosecutors and a Department of Justice that is bending and contorting the law inside out. And it's just being accepted and it's allowed to go forward. And so he said that's what we call J6 jurisprudence, which is we don't know what to expect anymore because you can't count on the law being applied as it's traditionally ever been.
100%. If you needed more evidence that we have fallen under a dictatorship, there you go. We are no longer under law. The things that are happening are not lawful. They're not about actual events that happen. They are about the whim and will of a dictator. and a dictatorship. Brandon, we're looking forward to having you next month. And we'll, of course, we'll have an update on everything that's going on. But I just want to thank you for being so transparent, for never backing down. It's so important. We talked about this. It's so important to stay out there, keep your face out there, make sure nobody forgets what has happened to you and so many others on January 6th. Thank you for being with us. And we'll continue to share everything that you're doing out with our audience.
Thank you so much. And if I may say, if there's anybody out there who wants to help support as I go through this, they can go to my website, brandonstrock.com. My last name is Straka. I could really use people's help right now. This is going to be a really tough battle that I'm in for with this civil case.
You absolutely have it. Thank you, Brandon.
The problem with weak men is that weak men create a vacuum, and the vacuum is always filled with something else.
Dr. Mark McDonald joins us today. He has a new book out called Freedom from Fear, a 12-step guide to personal and national recovery. His thoughts are going to be very compelling. He is a world-renowned psychiatrist who dealt with the worst of the worst during the pandemic, and he joins us today. Dr. McDonald, thank you for being with us today. You've been a voice very loudly calling out the criminal activities of the mandates, the unreasonable requirements, and of course, the isolation of people, the masking of people. You've been a loud, outspoken voice. We appreciate that. And you're here with a new book.
Yes, Freedom from Fear, a 12-step guide to a personal and national recovery. It's my second book, and it comes on the heels of my first one I published a year ago, called United States of Fear, which was really about the big problem in our country and how we got here. And this book is how do we get out of it, and how do we get out of it as individuals rather than how do we get out of it as a nation?
Well, I want to jump in the book for in just a moment, but it, really the premise is the idea that we can't heal as a country, as families, as communities, until there's been some acknowledgement of what has gone on in this nation. And it made me think the Atlantic article that was written by Emily Oster, that declared there should be a pandemic amnesty. What's your thoughts on that?
That idea is probably not only the stupidest idea, but one of the most destructive and completely non-implementable ideas in years. And the reason is very simple, and this is not just a political issue. It's very straightforward. When there's been damage, when there's been harm, when you have hurt someone, you do not get a pass. Amnesty is a pass. And the only time that amnesty ever works is if there is reconciliation, like there was with the Hutus and the Tutsis in Rwanda, which is something I cited in several of my articles, and I think in my first book. Mm-hmm. What this means is if you wish to be forgiven, you have to make amends. And I think that this amnesty proclamation is really disingenuous. It's a way for people who know that they're guilty to be able to get a free ride and not actually have to pay those amends or make them. And that I don't support at all, because if they get away with that, there will be no moving forward. There will simply be resentment and distrust forever.
I hear you on that. And the reality is the article goes on to say we didn't have the information. We didn't know. I mean, there's a million excuses for the poor treatment, the debilitating treatment, the death of thousands and thousands of elderly people, the suicidal tendencies of children now. All these excuses were laid out in this article, and none of them really carry any weight or any fact when we have people like you who from the very beginning were saying this is not right. It was really a matter of who they chose to listen to.
For that reason, I think that it's disingenuous. What we've seen in the last 3 years is not a series of errors. If it were a series of errors, then I might be more receptive to this idea of amnesty. But it's not. It's a series of knowledgeable, concerted, planned efforts to harm people. So When you see that, now you actually have a guilty party. This is not an accidental manslaughter charge. This is a first-degree murder charge. And we don't give amnesty to those people. That is a problem, that is a mistake, and that is the way they're trying to wiggle out of their responsibilities and not be accountable. And in my book, I write, the first thing you have to do as an individual, if you want to move forward, is hold yourself accountable. Admit that you have a problem, admit that you've harmed people. If you don't do that, it's game over.
So your point in the book, first of all, the stories are incredible. They seem to be fiction. I can't believe that this would be true. I just really can't. And so just for the pure read of it, for people to understand the spirit of fear and how it really affects people and what it did to people, these reminders are just absolutely incredible. And then you go into this idea of the reconciliation process. It's very direct. It's very firm. And since you work with and advise people all the time, Can you, I don't want to give it all away. People need to get the book. They need to marinate on this. I literally marked it up. I went back several times again because it is about the pandemic. It is about reconciliation over what happened there, but I honestly found it very personal. I found it to be very personal. It's just an excellent book. So walk us through maybe just the first step. Someone who has found themselves bound up in fear, so much so they were willing to harm other people. They were willing to exclude other people. They were willing to do all the things that we thought we'd never see again since World War II. They did these things to people. And the first step is what?
You must admit that you have harmed others and hold yourself accountable. If we pull this from the macro into the micro and think about it as a metaphor, and I use this in the book, similar to AA or any sort of recovery program, 12 steps, we all know either we've been in those programs or we know people who have been. I don't think there's any exception in this country to that. We know how the process works. And the process works by you admitting that you have a problem. And in, you know, the case of 12 steps, it's some form of addiction. Once you admit that you have a problem, now you can move forward. That's always the first step. Always, always, always. And that plays out in the pandemic as well.
Have you had people that have come to you and said, okay, I'm in this place now where someone has come to me and said, I'm so sorry for what I did. And how do you advise them? How is that reciprocation in your mind?
Well, it's a beautiful first step, because if someone sincerely approaches you and said, I made a mistake, or I harmed someone knowingly, either way, and I want to make amends, I want to do something to fix it, you should absolutely support that process. You should congratulate that person and express gratitude for him or her holding himself accountable for having done something wrong and harmed someone. That is the first step towards solving this problem. Just like you would support someone who's an addict, who's an alcoholic, or who uses cocaine and says, I've messed up my life, I've wrecked my family, I've lost my job, I'm divorced, my children are estranged from me, and I know that I did it. It wasn't the environment, it was me. What do I do next? Thank you for holding yourself accountable. I will support you as long as you are doing that and being honest. Once accountability and honesty go away, I think that the best thing, just like you would with a drug addict, is not to collude with them and support them in the dishonesty, but to separate, take yourself away so that they then have to come back to you and ask for forgiveness again.
You have a scene in the book when you're in a restaurant and a grown man, you say something to a mother who has her child masked up. This is well into the pandemic. We all know what's going on. Everybody, you know, the masks are a front. They're not real. And you say something, you ask the mother why the child's masked, and it leads to this whole ordeal where the husband comes back to you in the restaurant and just starts attempting to obliterate you. And you go on to talk about what weak men have contributed to this whole paralysis of our society. Would you just share a little bit about that? What is it to be a weak man? What does that look like? I mean, if a man thinks he's just defending his wife who has unnatural and abnormal fears, why is that wrong?
The problem with weak men is that weak men create a vacuum, and the vacuum is always filled with something else. And what it's been filled with in the last few years is hysteria. And often hysteria from women. Women are naturally more emotional than men, and that's not a bad thing. But without a counterbalance, when men pull away, when their containment of emotions and emotionality is withdrawn, women are forced to jump into that space and to try to take over that space as if they were men. And they're not. Women are not men, and men are not women, no matter what we're told. They're different. Vive la différence. And so the women then, not able to fill that role, at least not over a chronic long-term period. They can in emergency situations, like in wars. They were wonderful in World War II, but we wouldn't want women becoming our long-term factory workers making munitions for the next 60 years. Mm-hmm. So when women then have to fill that space, they're not able to contain their own emotions under that stress for a long period of time. So they start acting out like this mother did with her child and trying to fill the void of protection and security abdicated by, in this case, her husband, and doing it in an irrational, emotional way that wound up harming her child. I do believe very strongly that if men had held their ground, if men had stood up to the initial fear and the initial stress that was placed on all of us to stay home and quiver and say, you know what, we're not having that. Not in this house. I am in charge of our safety and security. I will make sure that my family is safe. go away. I think the women, at least the women in relationships who are married, not the single women who are living in apartments taking money from the government, but most women would have relaxed and said, thank you. I'll go back to the way that I was, being a good wife and mother. I'll let you handle that. And we wouldn't have had these scenes of children being pushed on with masks in bathrooms in Ojai, California, which is what I described in the book.
It's really, you describe it as an addiction. Fear is an addiction. It requires a reprogramming. That's what your book offers. It's called Freedom from Fear, a 12-step guide to personal and national recovery. And like I said, Dr. McDonald, I benefited greatly on a personal level. There's a lot to be learned from someone like you who has looked these things straight in the face, and you've suffered for it. And you're still suffering for it. And yet you do the right thing anyway. It's men like you that we need to be mirroring in this society. So thank you for everything that you're doing.
Thank you, Sharona.
In Dr. McDonald's book, Freedom Over Fear, there's a passage in here about a 72-year-old woman who, during the height of COVID, hid herself away completely. She had previously been fit, but she was sedentary. She got overweight. She got depressed. Her fear addiction spiraled out of control so much that her mind and her body began to deteriorate. And here's what happened. One day in summer of 2021, she woke up. She looked in the mirror and she thought to herself, I don't like the person I've become. This is not the life I want. And in that moment, she took her mask off, never to wear it again. And she decided to live. That's what we need to do. And we need to share that vision with those around us, our friends who have not yet come on board with the idea that liberty is good, freedom is good, and personal choices are good. Those who have not come on with the idea yet that we need to live, we've got to help them live. And you do that by your example. You do that by not caving into their fear addiction. Thank you guys for being with us on America's Mom. Remember, all that is necessary for evil to prevail is for good men and women to do the thing.
Small Business Alliance Network is here to bring American innovators and American small business together. To find your people and expand your American network, go to smallbusinessalliancenetwork.com, find your people, sign up today. We're on a mission to take market shares away from the CCP. Join us at patriotswitch.com/mom to support American-made companies, American-made manufacturing, and America workers first. patriotswitch.com/mom. We learned with Balenciaga that high fashion traditionally celebrates death. Why not celebrate life? Culture of Life 1972, support high fashion and a conscience. COL1972.com/mom. Who doesn't enjoy a great night of sleep or fabulous slippers for your toes? Go to mypillow.com, use code word MOM, and get the great American Patriot Mike Lindell's amazing pillow, slippers, and there's so much more. The sheets are incredible. Go to mypillow.com/mom today.
It was hard times living in a system that was too scared to share the truth and make a difference. I was sitting in a vision, then I saw the vision. I would multiply the love and subtract the division. And I'm not a mathematician, but it didn't add up. Praising politicians when they try to mask us. They say they're about the science, but they fake the data. They say they're gonna save us, but they really lab rat us. I don't really want a blindfold. See both sides or keep your eyes closed. Still accept the lies, well, sorry I don't. All that we deny will still be exposed. And I know these are hard times living. Most of us have reached our limit. The devil on attack with more clone gimmicks. There's no more time to be timid. Live this life with the light of the risen. 'Cause I don't gotta wait no more. Chasing after things that they just can't tell you. Tell me I don't.